Doesn't pop up. Dale has to study WW scattering, and you all know the usual argument. No Higgs field means strong coupling. So there may be some strong coupling physics lurking behind the TEV scale, which could be very interesting for phonology and for theoretical particle physics. And so it's kind of useful to know what are the general constraints on the dynamics of quantum field theory in 3+1 dimensions. Knowing such constraints could be very useful in deciphering this new physics when time comes. Also, general properties of renormalization group flows pose many interesting open questions relating the micro and the macro physics of various systems. So it's interesting from the theoretical point of view of learning some lessons about quantum field theory to know what are the constraints about the connection between the laws that govern the microphysics and the laws that emerge to govern the macrophysics. So there are also applications to condensed matter systems. This is originally where like some interesting applications of constraints on energy flows were developed. And also, recently, we had many interesting ingredients coming in from supersymmetry, from ADS-CFT, and these new perspectives help us identify which questions about energy flows are feasible and interesting. So we have a lot of input from modern physics in this sense. And that kind of ties nicely with the old aspects. Okay. So the particular question that I'm going to discuss today is the existence of a certain function, a certain abstract function that, as an input, it takes any CFT. And as an output, it spits out a real number. So it's a function that acts on theories and spits out real numbers, a functional. The question that I'm going to ask is whether this function or functional can be cooked up to satisfy an inequality, such that if one conformal field theory flows to another conformal field theory at long distances, whether you can cook up a function such that this inequality is satisfied, or meaning that this function decreases as you flow from the UV to the infrared. This function is called DOF after degrees of freedom, because the naive intuition from weakly coupled energy flows is that you integrate out massive particles, and so whatever this function is, it should be some kind of generalization of the number of particles in the system. We all expect from a weakly coupled physics that when you go to large distances, essentially what happens is that you get rid of all the fields that decay exponentially, the massive fields, and so this function is some kind of counting of the number of degrees of freedom. You can also try to go a bit further and establish a monotonic function that actually interpolates between these two edge values of DOF in the deep UV and the deep infrared. Okay, so that's the rough question that I'm going to discuss. And now I'll just list some possible applications. It's not just a question about the mathematical structure of quantum field theory. There are very, very down-to-earth applications. And people have already pursued such applications, assuming that such a function exists without having a proof. So if sometimes the solutions to Tuft's anomaly equations are too complicated, so Tuft's anomaly conditions sometimes are extremely complicated, and the solutions necessitate hundreds of fields, there are such examples which are pretty simple, then you could easily get a contradiction to this inequality. And then you could establish rigorously that there is symmetry breaking, and that kind of stuff could be important for even LHC kind of physics. If, for example, you have some chiral field theory where there are complicated anomalies, and it's extremely hard to recover it, to reproduce these anomalies by some infrared degrees of freedom, then you could establish that there is symmetry breaking. And there are examples where such logic is at play. You can also establish the opposite. If, for example, some symmetry is broken, then you know that you gotta get some Nambu-Goldstone bosons. But sometimes there are just too many Nambu-Goldstone bosons. And again, a contradiction to this inequality would imply that there is no symmetry breaking. So you see that you could get either symmetry breaking or no symmetry breaking from such an inequality. Also, from the more mathematical point of view, if such a function exists, then you can prove that there are no cycles in renormalization group flows, meaning that if one theory flows to another, you can never go back. So once you've added some relevant operator that takes one CFT to another CFT in the infrared, there is no relevant operator that you can add to CFTB such that it goes back to CFTA. That's because there is this function that decreases under any relevant perturbation. So there are no cycles, and that's important for for knowing, you know, the global space of quantum field theory. And again, there are some applications to condensed matter systems. Oh. Okay, so I'll summarize what is the state of the art in this field of putting some constraints on RG flows and knowing whether there is a function DOF or not. So actually, in quantum mechanics, there is a proposal. So you can make this, you can make a version of this question in quantum mechanics. It's known by the, it goes by the name the G theorem by Affleck and Ludwig from the 90s, sometime in the 90s. And in fact, it's not been proven, even though it's quantum mechanics, and you would think that everything about quantum mechanics is known and solvable. There is this simple conjecture by Affleck and Ludwig, which has not been proven, unless you are looking at some special cases, which were addressed by Friedan and collaborators, in which case you could, they managed to make some progress. So in general, there is an open question in quantum mechanics that's waiting to be solved, and the G theorem has been important for the Kondo model and many other interesting condensed matter applications. In 1 plus 1 dimensions, the problem has been sort of exhaustively solved by Zamolochikov. He not only proved that such a function exists, he also constructed this function. He showed, so basically in 1 plus 1 dimensions, every conformal field theory has associated to it some central charge, C. And Zamolochikov merely proposed that the real number that is associated to any conformal field theory is the central charge, C. Then he proved that the central charge must decrease monotonically, and so on. Today, if I have any time, I'll give you a new, very simple and intuitive proof of this result based on some new ideas. So I may or may not get to that, but maybe I'll display proof of that later in the talk. Yeah. Yeah, my assumptions about the theory are more or less identical to Zamolochikov's. Well, there is some general idea that I'm going to advocate, and using this general idea, you can prove this theorem in a new way. So that's kind of interesting. Now, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, there's been a very inspiring proposal from here, from the Perimeter Institute. It was quite recent by Rob Myers and Aninda Sinha. Then people like Jeffries, some people at Princeton, Jeffries, Klebanov, Puffo, and Safdie also calculated some examples of this proposal. And there is some evidence that this proposal is true. It's based on holography, some perturbative calculations that were done by these people, and some n equals 2 models. So there is a very interesting proposal in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and it's very likely to be true. However, there is no proof yet. And also the evidence is not as extensive as it could be. OK, so in 3 plus 1 dimensions, there is a proposal by Cardi from the 80s that the number of degrees of freedom associated to some four-dimensional conformal field theory should be A, where A is some trace anomaly. So similarly to 2 dimensions, there are anomalies in four-dimensional conformal field theories. And Cardi proposed that there should be a similar formula in 4 dimensions, like in 1 plus 1. And A is some specific trace anomaly. There has been a lot of evidence over the years. Some people did explicit calculations in various models, and there has been quite an extensive evidence for that. So the main message of today's lecture would be that I'll tell you of some general ideas that are applicable in every dimension, and then in 4 dimensions, these ideas would lead to a proof of the A theorem, of the so-called A theorem. Okay. So what is this A anomaly? So I'm not going to talk about it too much, but every 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory has an A anomaly. And if you just want to get some intuition of what does it count, if you take a free field theory, that formula is only true for free field theories, then for free field theories, it counts the number of scalars plus the number of fermions plus the number of gauge fields with these specific weights. So it's just one specific way of counting the number of degrees of freedom. There are, of course, many other ways. But only that kind of thing works. If you change this number from 62 to 61, it doesn't work anymore in interacting field theories, okay? So this is a very particular object, and it's also positive. You can prove that for every unitary conformal field theory, this A is positive. And that has also been done quite recently by these people. And it's also kind of surprising that this, among many other candidates for quantities that could decrease along RG flows, only this guy seems to work. For instance, the free energy doesn't seem to work. The free energy is what the cosmologists would call the number of degrees of freedom, and that you would also expect to decrease under energy flows by the usual intuition that you lose massive particles, but the free energy doesn't work. There are very simple examples in which you can see that the flow does not decrease the free energy. On the contrary, the free energy increases in the infrared. So there are some examples like that. So some, what you would call intuitively the number of degrees of freedom, doesn't quite work. It's this quite abstract object, which is this A anomaly, that does work. In two dimensions, the central charge of Zamolodchikov coincides with the free energy. So in two dimensions, the free energy decreases and the central charge decreases. But in four dimensions, these objects do not coincide, and only one of them seems to work. Are there any questions about the introduction? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about these trace anomalies a bit. I'll prove some version of the A theorem that, well, one might call the little A theorem, and then I'll discuss the general example, the general case. Then I'll discuss some examples, which are new, not published yet, some interesting examples where you can compute interesting quantities. If I have time, I'll get to a proof of Zamolodchikov's theorem using the same tools, but basically, if you get the idea, then this should be quite straightforward. And then I'll discuss some open questions, which are still outstanding. Right, so what is conformal symmetry, and how do you break conformal symmetry? So what I'm going to start discussing is what happens when you spontaneously break a conformal symmetry. That seems to have a priori nothing to do with the problem that I set out to solve, but that's an important set of ideas to discuss, as you'll see. So let's discuss any conformal field theory in which conformal symmetry is broken spontaneously. Conformal symmetry could be broken spontaneously by giving some VEVs to operators, and so on. And the Nambu-Goldstone theorem, the Nambu-Goldstone theorem guarantees that if you break spontaneously conformal symmetry, then you get a massless dilaton. So there is a massless field in the spectrum of a conformal, of a system in which conformal symmetry is broken spontaneously. So the question is, how do you write Lagrangians for the dilaton? This is what people used to do in the 60s when they discussed pions and current algebras and so on. There are constraints on the Lagrangian of the dilaton imposed by the conformal symmetry. So it's nonlinearly realized conformal symmetry, and it imposes some severe constraints on the effective action of the dilaton. So how do you find what are the constraints? There are many ways. One simple way is to introduce some background metric, and I emphasize that this is a background metric. It's not going to be dynamical at any point. And then what you require is that your Lagrangian is invariant under rescalings of the metric, but in this fashion, and simultaneous shifts of the dilaton. This is basically Weyl symmetry. So what I'm doing is, instead of imposing the constraints on the dilaton directly, I'm introducing some background metric, and I'm imposing that the dilaton coupled to this metric enjoys Weyl symmetry. If it enjoys Weyl symmetry, then it's guaranteed that when you go back to flat space, there will be nonlinearly realized conformal symmetry. So one object that is kind of useful for calculations is this G hat, which is another definition of the metric, with this weight e to the minus 2 tau, because this guy is invariant under Weyl symmetry, as you see, manifestly. So now you could try to write Lagrangians, which are Weyl invariant, involving the metric and the dilaton. Up to two derivatives, it's pretty simple. You have the cosmological constant, which is manifestly Weyl invariant, because this determinant is for this metric G hat, which is Weyl invariant by itself. And then the two derivatives, you could write the Ricci scalar. And that's all there is to it, up to two derivatives. You can now go back to flat space. You go back to flat space by putting the metric to be flat. And what you get is the usual kinetic term for the dilaton. So that looks like an interacting field, but actually it's a free field in disguise. You can shift to coordinates in which it's manifestly just a free field. Just e to the minus tau would be a free field in these coordinates. Okay. So what you get the two derivatives is more or less what you expect. There is a dilaton, and it has a kinetic term. But this whole technology becomes really useful when you go to four derivatives and you try to write Weyl invariant Lagrangians. So at four derivatives, there are three coefficients that could be present a priori. We call them kappa 1, 2, and 3. And they could multiply these objects, R hat squared, the Ricci tensor squared, and the Riemann tensor squared. All of these guys could be present in some effective field theory for the dilaton. So a priori, we don't know what these coefficients are, but you'll see that most of them are not important. Or actually, all of them don't give any physical dilaton terms in the action, as you'll see in a moment. So the way to see that none of these coefficients contributes to some physical observables is to switch to a different basis where it's more manifest. So there is a different basis based on this Euler density and the Weyl tensor squared. So these are some simple connections, some simple equations relating the Euler density and the Weyl tensor squared. So we can switch to this basis, nothing deep so far. And now the observation is that the coefficient of the Weyl tensor squared cannot be of any interest if you are going to study dilaton actions in flat space, because when you set flat the space to be flat, this hat metric, this hatted metric G hat, is conformal to the flat metric. And since the Weyl tensor vanishes on conformally flat metrics, this is not going to contribute to any observable in flat space. Similarly, this Euler density is a total derivative. The Euler density is known to be a topological term, and so this also goes away. So all you are left with at the level of four derivatives is this Ricci scalar squared, and then you just compute it. It's pretty easy to compute the Ricci scalar squared in flat space, and you get this object. You get this box tau minus d tau squared. So you see that it's some four derivative term, but this particular four derivative term vanishes on shell. The equations of motion of the original two derivative theory were exactly box tau equals d tau squared. So what happens is that the only term that's present at four derivatives actually vanishes on shell. So you see that basically if the constraints of conformal symmetry lead to the conclusion that there is no genuine four derivative term in the action. Yeah. Yeah, so in writing these equations, I've ignored the cosmological constant term. I did not say why, but the reason is that if you have spontaneously broken conformal symmetry, if it's a gen, then the cosmological constant term must not be present. Because once you have, you know, you have a moduli space of vacua for some conformal field theory, and you go somewhere in this moduli space of vacua, then there is no potential, because by definition, all these vacua are degenerate. So in the genuine conformal field theory, this would be zero. This is also why they say that you could solve the cosmological constant problem if our universe was in some phase which breaks conformal symmetry spontaneously. Because if conformal symmetry is only broken spontaneously, there cannot be a cosmological constant term. Okay, so this guy is not present, and then the equations of motion are just those. And yeah. Yes, so I'll get to that. So far I'm just discussing what would happen if the only massless field is the dilaton. But I'll explain shortly why the dilaton must be decoupled from any other state. The quick answer to this question, if you want just an intuitive answer, is that the Nambu-Goldstone theorem guarantees that you have a massless particle which has a pole that goes like 1 over q squared at zero momentum. And from the general axioms of quantum field theory, if there is a pole at zero momentum, if the spectral function contains something like 1 over q squared, at zero momentum, then this must be decoupled from everything else because it's an isolated pole. Something that's coupled to something else would have branch cuts. But you know, the Nambu-Goldstone theorem guarantees that there is a 1 over q squared in some two-point function of currents and something else. So once you have a 1 over q squared, it must be decoupled from everything else in the deep low energy limit. Of course, it could be coupled at some intermediate energies, but since you have a pole at zero momentum, it must be a free particle in the infrared. Okay. Okay. So the conclusion from the analysis of the constraints of conformal symmetry is that there are no four derivative terms in the dilaton Lagrangian. Okay. This by itself is extremely problematic, as I will explain shortly. The quantum field theory necessitates four derivative terms in the Lagrangian by unitarity. So there are simple unitarity constraints on quantum field theory, which tell you that there cannot be quantum field theories in which there are no four derivative terms in the low energy effective action. So we're facing some paradox, as you'll see in a moment, and the resolution of this paradox will be anomalies. So now let me just cover briefly how anomalies come into this business, and then you'll see how they resolve the potential paradox with unitarity. So what anomalies tell us is that, in fact, even though I was considering Weyl invariant actions, that cannot be the whole story. Four-dimensional quantum field theories have anomalies, meaning that the action of the dilaton cannot be fully Weyl invariant. Something must reproduce the anomaly. there are two anomalies in four dimensions. One is called the A anomaly. This is, of course, the hero of the story. This is the guy that satisfies all these nice properties. And there is another anomaly in four dimensions, which is called the C anomaly, which is a bit less interesting. But you cannot, so what, but what it tells you is that your anomaly, your functional, your effective action cannot be fully invariant under diff cross while, because under while transformations, it has to pick up this anomaly. So the small computational task that you have to do now is you have to write Lagrangians which reproduce this anomaly. Okay, that's a small technical exercise, which I won't bother you with. But the solution is very simple. There is, well, of course, the solution is not unique because you can add to this anomalous functional any functional that is while invariant. So the solution is only defined up to while invariant terms. But in some choice of the conventions, the anomaly is reproduced in the following way. So the C anomaly is reproduced by the dilaton coupling to this while tensor squared. So the C anomaly is in some sense abelian. It doesn't there is no Wesomino procedure that has to be invoked. I'll explain in a moment why that is. So the C anomaly is in some sense trivial and abelian, while the A anomaly turns out to be in some sense non-abelian, because to fix this anomaly functional, you have to add a lot of terms. And even though the anomaly exists only when you couple the metric, when you couple the theory to some to some curved metric, in fact, the necessity, the non-abelian nature of this anomaly forces you in the end to introduce some terms that survive even when the metric is said to be flat. So this is the term that I want you to concentrate on, even though this is the same kind of thing. But you see that this term is necessitated by the existence of the anomaly, even though the anomaly exists only in curved space. So this is the term for the dilaton interaction, which survives the limit where the metric is taken to be flat. And it's there because the anomaly is non-abelian. In pion physics, there is something extremely reminiscent of that, which is called the Wesomino-Witten term in pion physics. So there is a particular term in pion physics, which is responsible for the kaon decay to three pions. And its presence is also, it's also mandated by the existence of some chiral anomaly, even though the chiral anomaly disappears formally when you set the gauge fields, the background gauge fields, to zero. So there is a very similar phenomenon here, that some non-abelian structure forces you to introduce a self-dilaton coupling at four derivatives, which is exactly what we need. So in the end, if you don't, the details are not very important. In the end, what one finds is that the anomalous functional introduces exactly the piece that was missing by unitarity. As you'll see, unitarity implies that such pieces must exist. And it's universal. So this four derivative dilaton coupling is universally proportional to the A anomaly. And essentially, I mean, this is what leads to all the nice results that would ensue. Because once you have a four derivative coupling that is completely universal, and there is some unitarity constraints on these guys, so in the end, unitarity is going to lead to an inequality too. Okay, so this is where all the juice comes from, the fact that there is some universal four derivative term for the dilaton at low energies. Okay, so now the last thing that I skimmed over, and I just want to say quickly why that is true. I want to explain why the C anomaly is in some sense trivial and abelian, while the A anomaly is non-abelian. So if you look at this equation, which defines the anomalous functional, the way you solve these kind of things is by the Wesomino procedure, that you replace the sigma by tau, because tau shifts under well transformations inhomogeneously. So the first iteration in solving this equation would be to replace sigma by tau, but then you have to keep fixing this procedure, because whatever is in parentheses could by itself be non-invariant under Weyl transformations. However, for the C anomaly, what you find is the Weyl tensor squared, which is by itself invariant under Weyl transformations. So for the C anomaly, as soon as you replace the sigma by tau, the procedure terminates. This is what happens in QED. Well, this is why I'm calling it an abelian anomaly. The U1 anomaly in QED is like that, that it doesn't necessitate higher order corrections in tau. It just stops at the first order. While E4, this guy E4, which is the Euler density, is not invariant under Euler transformations. And so putting a tau here is not enough. You have to keep fixing it. And it terminates as soon as you get to this four tau, four derivative terms. Okay? So that's why one of them is anomalous and one is not. Okay, so now I'll go through a small digression explaining why any quantum field theory has to have four derivative terms, or energy to the four effects at low energies. So that's disconnected from in some sense from the main development of this lecture, but it's something that's good to know. All right, so let's look at any quantum field theory which contains a massless spin zero particle. Let's call this particle tau. We could then look at the 2-2-2 scattering of this particle. So let's look at tau to tau, tau tau goes to tau tau. So this is some specific scattering that one may be interested in. And one could start, one could expand this scattering amplitude at low energies, right? So we could start expanding it in S, T, and U, while remembering that since the particle is massless, S plus T plus U is zero. So the first term that you can write down, which doesn't vanish by the obvious symmetries that S goes to T and S goes to U, is S squared plus T squared plus U squared. This is an energy to the 4 term with some coefficient alpha. Then there could be corrections, which are energy to the 6, and so on and so forth. So this is the most general low energy expansion of some 2-2-2 scattering process in quantum field theory.
Why you don't have codes?
What?
Why you don't have codes? 1 over S?
Yes, I'm assuming that this is the, I'm assuming that in this Lagrangian, it's like in pi in physics. This is what I have in mind, that in this is some Lagrangian where there is an expansion in derivatives of this massless particle tau, and that's it. So there are no other massless particles for except for this tau, and you write some effective action, right? I'm basically assuming that there is an effective action for tau. I'm not assuming anything beyond that. No, not if this particle is derivatively coupled. If this particle only appears with derivative in the action, then every time you have a propagator, you'd have enough derivatives in the vertices to cancel the singularities. Okay? So if you assume that there is a massless particle which with a shift symmetry, so that it's only derivatively coupled, then the scattering amplitude won't have any pulse. Okay?
You said one problem.
Well, I can show you how this works. It's quite simple. So
this is for a specific theory, not for a general spin zero, theory of a massless spin zero particle.
Yeah, this is for spin zero particles which are derivatively coupled. So if it's derivatively coupled, then there are no poles in the scattering amplitudes. Okay, so then or in other words, if the amplitudes are regular, this would be the most general expansion. So now so the way to prove that this coefficient must be positive, non-zero, and positive, is to go to the forward limit. The forward limit is when this T invariant, the Mandelstam invariant T is zero. And physically what it means is that at the center of mass, tau, the initial state, has zero angle between the two taus in the initial state. Okay, so the angle depends, of course, on the frame. But in the center of mass frame, when you set T to zero, the angle goes to zero. So it's like forward scattering. And this formula simply collapses to that. And now you do some small analytic argument, Cauchy-like argument. You divide the amplitude by S cubed. Sorry, that's a typo. You divide the amplitude by S cubed. Then you see that there is a pole at S equals to zero. And so when you close the contour, you pick up the pole. That gives you the left-hand side of this equation. While the rest at non-zero S, you have a branch cut. Like any amplitude, you would have a branch cut. And so you'd pick an integral over the branch cut. However, the integral over the branch cut is positive definite because the branch cut, by the optical theorem, is the same as the scattering amplitude. This is the optical theorem, and so you get that this coefficient alpha is given by the integral over the scattering amplitude of tau tau goes to anything. So is that argument clear? Or I could go into more detail if you've not seen such arguments before. Okay, so I assume that that's clear. So That implies that alpha cannot be zero, and in fact, it has to be positive. So this is why, if there were no anomalies in 4 dimensions, in particular, if there were no A anomaly, you would face a Grimm contradiction, because the conformal symmetry by itself shows that there are no 4 derivative terms in the action.
Do you assume something about the behavior at infinity?
Yes. So for this argument, I've merely just assumed the famous Froissart bound. That's enough to guarantee convergence. In the case that I'm going to discuss, I can prove convergence is even much simpler than, you don't need to assume Froissart even. But yeah, so I should also say that these kind of arguments are extremely old. In the context of the Carol Lagrangian, people have already realized that there are such constraints on pion physics in the 80s, and there is a nice paper by Pham and Trong where they've shown that some coefficients in the pion Lagrangian ought to be positive. Due to such reasoning, and indeed these coefficients have been measured and they are positive. There are also constraints like that on longitudinal scattering of W and Z bosons, because the longitudinal scattering of W and Z bosons is almost like pine physics. So Distler, Greenstein, Porto, and Rothstein emphasized that there are constraints on W and Z boson scattering from positivity. There are also implications for fermion interactions that have been worked out by these people. And there are also applications of supersymmetry that I worked on in the past with Michael Dine and Guido Festuccia. Also, there has been a very nice recent interpretation of such positivity constraints, a physical interpretation by Adams, Harkani Hamed, Dubovsky, Nicolis, and Rotazzi. And they had their applications for some modified theories of gravity. So this field, yeah? Okay. So you see that there are quite many aspects or facets to this unitarity constraints. I'm only going to use the simple version of it that I've told you about a moment ago. Right. So a. No, because this is positive definite. So that would mean that the theory is essentially free. You see that you integrate over the total cross section of tau tau going to anything at all energies. So if alpha is zero, that would mean that the total cross section is zero, which would mean that tau is completely decoupled at all energy scales. So if your theory is not free, it has to be positive. Okay, so now I'm going to prove the A theorem in a version of the most general question that you could ask. And in fact, this version of the A theorem is interesting because there has been recently a counterexample, an alleged counterexample by Tachikawa and Shapir. And this counterexample was exactly in this space of theories that I'm going to discuss now. So it's interesting to start from this kind of theories and to prove this A theorem in this class of theories. Okay? Of course, this counterexample has been debunked, but it's still an interesting class of models, and there are many models like that. So I'm going to discuss exactly which kind of models are going to be relevant for it. So let's consider some conformal field theory, which I'm denoting conformal field theory UV. This describes the microscopic physics. And I'm assuming that the anomalies of this conformal field theory are some A and C. Okay, this is the notation. And now I'm assuming that this theory has some moduli space of vacua, such that you could break conformal symmetry spontaneously. So this is the space of vacua. And now we're going to break conformal symmetry spontaneously. And then, of course, the dilaton must be massless, since it's a Nambu-Goldstein boson of conformal symmetry. In addition to it, there may be other massless particles, which is what Amit asked in the beginning. So in addition to the massless dilaton, there could be a whole infrared conformal field theory of massless particles that I'm denoting CFT-IR. And this conformal field theory would have anomalies A and C IR. So that the anomalies could be completely different between the IR and the UV. The task that I'm going to address now is to prove that the anomalies of this conformal field theory in the infrared are the A anomaly smaller than the A anomaly of the conformal field theory in the UV. So that's not the most general energy flow in four dimensions. It's just those which can be described by a spontaneous breaking of conformal symmetry. But there are many supersymmetric theories in which there is such a moduli space of vacua. And these flows could be extremely intricate in many supersymmetric theories. They often cannot be understood by any ordinary means. And the conformal field theories that you encounter could be intractable. So it's interesting to try to prove an inequality. And such a realm is in such a realm, people have constructed this counterexample, which was later debunked. OK, so the main observation that you can make is that since the breaking of conformal symmetry is spontaneous, the total anomalies must match. This is the usual Tuft kind of argument from the 70s, that if your symmetry is only broken spontaneously, then the anomalies should match. But this does not mean that the A and C anomalies of the two conformal field theories match. It only means that the total anomaly of the infrared is the same as the total anomaly of the UV. And in the infrared, you also have the dilaton. And the dilaton by itself could carry some fraction of the anomaly. Okay. So this, since the total anomaly must match, the dilaton interaction must carry by itself the difference between the anomalies. So there is a conformal field theory in the infrared. There could be some corrections, which are some higher dimensional operators describing interactions of the dilaton and so on. But the main thing that we learned in the discussion of the constraints of conformal symmetry is that the four derivative dilaton coupling is universal, is proportional to the A anomaly. And therefore, in this context, since the dilaton must carry the difference between the anomalies for the total anomaly to match, the coefficient of the dilaton was, well, for this anomalous functional must be the difference between the anomalies. AUV minus AIR, okay? And this multiplies the kinetic, this fourth derivative term for the dilaton. Also, you must match the C anomalies, but as I told you, the abelian anomaly associated to the C anomaly is not very interesting. But for the A anomaly, it's quite interesting because that forces the fourth derivative term of the dilaton to be completely universal and be completely fixed by the difference between the anomalies. So once you go to flat space, all this notation becomes much simpler. So you have a conformal field theory in the infrared describing a bunch of massless particles. And then there could be some interactions for this dilaton, which is decoupled in the deep infrared. It has a kinetic term. It has some term that vanishes on shell. This is this term that I mentioned, which is while invariant but vanishes on shell. And then the fourth derivative term must be proportional to the difference between the A anomalies. Okay, and now you just write this sum rule that I had before. And you see that since this is forced to be positive by unitarity, it satisfies the sum rule, and you prove that the A anomaly in the infrared is smaller than the A anomaly in the UV. Okay? So are there any questions? Now what I'm going to explain is that essentially once you've covered this space of theories in which conformal symmetry is broken spontaneously, then you're done. It also covers the most general case automatically. Yeah?
There was some text indicating what the prime means.
Yeah, I didn't want to go into that, but if you really want to know, so you have in the infrared, you have a conformal field theory with anomalies AIR and CIR. And now you need to add this functional for the dilaton that compensates for the rest to match the total anomaly. But the dilaton is one boson in the infrared. It's also a single particle that has a, you know, a triangle diagram that gives you one unit for the anomaly. So the prime just indicates that this is the anomaly of the infrared conformal field theory plus one boson, one free boson. So in fact, what you prove is something stronger than the inequality I advertised. You prove that AIR plus one boson is smaller than AUV. I think Rob Myers pointed to us that we could do that first. Okay, so, right, so once I've covered, okay, so maybe now, Amit, is it more clear why is it decoupled, or I've not said anything new to this effect so far? So maybe I should explain a bit more why it has to be decoupled. So the dilaton, what it does is to fix Weyl symmetry, to fix the Weyl symmetry. It has this nonlinear transformation that makes every theory Weyl invariant. But if you have a conformal field theory in the infrared, this by itself is already Weyl invariant. So the dilaton cannot couple directly to the conformal field theory in the infrared. Or in other words, the definition of a conformal field theory is that if you change the metric by some overall factor, then this change decouples. So this doesn't give anything. So this is why the dilaton cannot couple directly to the conformal field theory. And it has to have these higher derivative terms, which are independent of the matter fields in the conformal field theory. And that logic is true if the dilaton is accompanied by other massless particles, if there is another free massless field, that the dilaton would always have to be decoupled from the conformal field theory in the infrared, because the dilaton is there to fix the conformal symmetry, and for the conformal field theory itself, it doesn't need to be fixed. So you can also check many examples and see that it works. Okay, so this is what I already said, that these kind of examples where you have some spontaneous breaking of conformal symmetry are very common in supersymmetry. So many supersymmetric models have moduli spaces of vacua, and you could study conformal symmetry breaking in this fashion. And of course, there was this counterexample that has been then debunked by Gayoto, Seiberg, and Tachikawa. So now there is no counterexample. Now I'm going to switch to the most general RG flow. So for that, I'll need like one picture. So the most general Wilsonian RG flow is that you start from some conformal field theory in the UV, and then you add some relevant operator, and you flow to some other conformal field theory in the infrared. And this is triggered by some mass term or some relevant operator that you've added to the theory. And the question is to prove that the A anomaly of the conformal field theory in the infrared is smaller than the conformal field theory in the UV. That's the essence of the A theorem. And so far, I've not addressed this case. I've addressed a slightly different kind of flow where you break conformal symmetry spontaneously and not by adding a mass term, which is explicit breaking. So indeed, the main difference between what I've discussed so far and the most interesting case is that here the breaking of conformal symmetry is explicit and not spontaneous. So there is no anomaly matching. There is no Tuft argument. And so you need to work more. But in fact, if you think about it, there isn't much more work to be done, because there is a very general lesson that everybody knows in physics, which is that any explicit symmetry breaking is completely equivalent to spontaneous symmetry breaking, or it's indistinguishable from spontaneous symmetry breaking, if the decay constant of the dilaton, or whatever number Goldstone boson you're introducing, is large enough. Or in other words, this is also what people call Spurian analysis. The essence of Spurian analysis is that if you have some parameter in the Lagrangian that breaks the symmetry explicitly, if you just convert this parameter into a space-time dependent function, and you think of it as some new field, then you restore the symmetry that this parameter breaks, and you can use everything that you've learned from theories in which the symmetry is present to constrain the dynamics of these theories. Okay? The simplest example of that is probably a particle moving in some electric field in quantum mechanics. So suppose you have quantum mechanics, and there is some electric field that, you know, and you have such a coupling to X or something. And now suppose you wanted, oh, sorry, yeah. There's one here. So suppose you have a quantum mechanics system where you introduce by hand some electric field that breaks rotational invariance. So the pessimistic point of view would be that you've broken a rotational symmetry, and so it's no longer a useful tool. But that point of view is wrong, because if you think about this electric field as a variable, and you assign to it some SO3 or SO4, however many dimensions you've got, transformations, then this invariance is recovered. But the physical implications are that if you computed the energy spectrum of this theory, like the energy spectrum of a particle in an electric field, then the fact that this parameter transforms under this SO3 or SO4 symmetry would imply that the energy spectrum must be only a function of E squared, for instance, right? So this kind of tricks everybody's familiar with. We take parameters that break the symmetry explicitly, and we assign them spurious transformation laws under the symmetries which they break explicitly, and in this way you recover the symmetry, and you can learn something about the physical spectrum or observable quantities. So what I'm going to do is essentially the same trivial trick. In the most general Wilsonian picture, which is triggered by some mass term in the Lagrangian, and where you break conformal symmetry by the presence of this mass term, you can think of this mass term as something that breaks the symmetry only spontaneously, since you can assign to this mass term formally transformation laws under conformal symmetry. So then basically whatever we've done before is still true. And the way you do it more rigorously is as follows. So take any quantum field theory, which is some function of fields and some function of masses, right? So what you do is you take every mass term, and you replace this mass term by m times omega, where omega is e to the minus tau. Then if you accompany conformal transformations by the shift of the dilaton tau, you recover conformal symmetry, because now we are basically thinking about every mass term as a spurion. That's what it does. This is what this this is what this redefinition does. So now the full theory does satisfy the traceless condition for the energy momentum tensor, and it's formally conformal, because we've assigned to every mass term some transformation property under conformal symmetry. And you can take this dilaton to be arbitrarily weakly coupled to the physical matter system by just taking the decay constant to be large. This is the essence of every time people do Spurian analysis. They think of the variables as fields, but these fields are almost decoupled. So the actual fluctuations are almost decoupled from the matter system, while the fields still depend on space-time. Here you achieve that by giving this dilaton an arbitrarily large coefficient in front of the kinetic term. Then all the physical fluctuations of the dilaton are arbitrarily weakly coupled to the matter system, because 1 over f would appear in front of every physical coupling. So what I'm saying is the usual trick of Spurian analysis. If a symmetry is broken explicitly, you can make it look like it's broken only spontaneously by adding a Goldstone boson with an arbitrarily large decay constant, so that the fluctuations are decoupled. So now the dilaton is almost decoupled. It doesn't interfere with the original massive flow. It doesn't do anything interesting because it's almost decoupled. And again, anomaly matching takes place, and you need the total anomalies to match, which, again, you get the same equations as before, and you get the same sum rule as before, and you prove the A theorem. So there is a particular sum rule that tells you that the difference between the anomalies is some positive integral which is bigger than zero. You can also formally define an A function that depends on the energy scale by cutting this integral at some intermediate energy scale and making it look like it's decreasing monotonically from the ultraviolet value of the A anomaly to the infrared value of the A anomaly. But this sum rule is the general punchline of this discussion. You can prove that it's independent of the cutoff. It's completely finite. You can prove that it's UV convergent because the dilaton only couples to relevant operators. And since it couples to relevant operators, it goes to zero when you go to very high energies because relevant operators become less and less important at higher energies. You can prove that it's infrared convergent because the dilaton only couples at low energies. The dilaton only couples to operators which are irrelevant. And so it's also convergent in the infrared. And you can also prove that it's completely finite cutoff independent because there are many derivatives. It comes from a term with four derivatives. And terms with four derivatives in quantum field theory in four dimensions are not sensitive to the cutoff. There are enough propagators, if you want, so that all the diagrams are UV convergent. So this is the final sum rule, and which proves the A theorem. So are there any questions about it? OK. Just to show you how it works in one specific example, so that you are not left mystified by this trick, let's consider a free massive particle, the simplest quantum field theory that you could imagine. This quantum field theory flows from a theory in the ultraviolet of one massless scalar to an empty theory in the infrared. So this is the flow. And the A theorem should hold, of course, for this setup. So what you do is that, as I promised, you replace the mass term by m to the e to the minus tau. Now this theory is formally conformally invariant, even though it's a massive particle. Since I'm now thinking about the mass as some space-time dependent coupling, this theory is now formally conformally invariant. And you can see that you can now integrate out this phi to read out the dilaton effective action. So you integrate out phi easily because it's a Gaussian integral, and you get this heat kernel, determinant of box plus m squared e to the minus tau. And now, miraculously, you expand this heat kernel in tau. You want to read out the effective action, and you find that this effective action for the heat kernel satisfies exactly the constraints that are mandated by conformal symmetry. And in particular, you get precisely that the structure is this term that vanishes on shell, plus exactly the coefficients that I told you that come from the anomaly functional. And the coefficient of these four derivative terms is exactly the known A anomaly for a massless free field. So everything works out exactly as needed. And in particular, one surprising thing is that if you expand this heat kernel, it actually terminates with four taus, which was a consequence of conformal symmetry. So conformal symmetry at the level of four derivatives tells you that there cannot be any terms with more than four taus. There cannot be terms like d to the four, tau to the six. This is forbidden by conformal symmetry. And indeed, this heat kernel miraculously terminates at four derivatives and four taus. And the coefficients are all as they should be. So there are three independent terms. And there are many equations that guarantee that this heat kernel gives you the results that are expected from conformal symmetry. Okay, you can also study more complicated flows, not just free flows. You can study what's called weakly relevant flows, where there is an operator that's almost relevant, then it flows a bit and stops. I'm not going to take you through the details. It's kind of boring. But these theories are already interacting, not just a free field, where you cannot do a Gaussian integral. There is some conformal field theory that evolves to another conformal field theory nearby by the presence of a weakly relevant operator. So you can do what's called conformal perturbation theory. And again, you follow the machinery, and you get, again, miraculously, that the effective action for the dilaton satisfies exactly all the constraints that need to be satisfied. In particular, there are no terms with more than four taus. And you can also extract the change in the A anomaly from the conformal field theory in the ultraviolet to the conformal field theory in the infrared. It's given by this nice, manifestly positive integral, where you see that you just integrate the beta function for this new coupling over some short range from 0 to lambda star, where lambda star is the coupling in the infrared. And it's manifestly positive. What's nice about it is this is why you also see why the A theorem is true. If the coupling grows, then it means that the beta function is negative, which means that delta A is positive. If some coupling goes down, then it means that the beta function is positive, which is, again, resulting in a positive change in the A anomaly. So you see that it doesn't matter how quantum field theories evolve, the sign of the beta function is correlated with the sign of the change of the coupling, this always conspires to give you a positive answer. So this is a nice sum rule that you get for this weakly relevant flows. You can also study Banach-like fixed points, and in Banach-like fixed points you can also compute everything by doing explicit perturbation theory, and you find similar integrals, and you again find exact agreement with the sum rule and with these constraints from conformal symmetry. So these are just some examples of how this procedure works. How much time do I have? Like till 5 o'clock.
Yeah, or you can run a little.
What time is it now?
5:02.
Okay, so I'll just take you quickly through the proof of the two-dimensional Zamolodchikov theorem, the new proof, using the same ideas, so that you see that you get what one is familiar with from two dimensions. So basically, in two dimensions, you can do this whole analysis from scratch. You can find the terms which are, you can find the constraints on the effective action of a dilaton in two dimensions. And there are no terms with two derivatives. So it was four derivatives in four dimensions. In two dimensions, it's terms with two derivatives. And one finds that without anomalies, there would be no terms with two derivatives for the dilaton. And the absence of terms with two derivatives is obviously against unitarity. So again, the same kind of logic leads you to sum rule for C, for the change in the central charge C while you flow from some UV field theory to some infrared field theory. And you get something like that, which then in position space becomes something like that. So basically, you follow the same logic. You find the same kind of sum rule, some total cross-section. And it can be written in this way. So the change in the central charge C in any two-dimensional quantum field theory is given by the integral over all of space of two insertions of the trace of the energy momentum tensor with x squared. And this is obviously positive because by reflection positivity, the two-point function has to be positive. So this nice sum rule is a proof of the two-dimensional C theorem. And you can, in fact, show that this sum rule is completely consistent with Zamolodchikov's proof. So you can take Zamolodchikov's proof and show that the change in C along the flow is given by this nice sum rule. And so basically, this proof that I've presented for Zamolodchikov's theorem is consistent with what Zamolodchikov has obtained himself using the old methods. So that's another some kind of reinforcement for this logic of using the dilaton to fix any massive flow. All right, so now I'll quickly discuss some open questions that still remain to be solved. So one open question, which I find very interesting, but I've not yet had time to work on it, is the fact that there is this Euler anomaly, the A anomaly, and it has some intrinsic non-abelian structure. It leads to some 2-to-2 scattering, which is completely universal, like in pion physics. But what is missing is an algebraic or cohomological analysis of this phenomenon. In the case of pion physics, the Wes-Zumino term received a lot of attention. Witten also came up with a nice five-dimensional integral that reproduces this Wes-Zumino-like term. So I guess some of you are familiar with this stuff. But since this 2-to-2 scattering, this universal coefficient has not been recognized before for conformal symmetry breaking, so I mean nobody discussed it before this paper, so it's still lacking. This cohomological analysis is still lacking, and it would be interesting to find it. So there's some algebraic structure here which is still ill understood, then it would be nice to fill these gaps. Now, another thing that's not clear is whether flows in four dimensions are gradient flows. We have only shown that AUV is bigger than A infrared, and we've constructed a monotonic function. But we have not shown that the flow from the UV to the infrared is a gradient flow. A gradient flow would mean that not only that this function decreases, it decreases in the fastest possible way, that it follows the path of least resistance, in some sense, to the infrared. So that would be interesting to see if it's indeed a gradient flow or not. Another thing that you might want to do is that, like for the chiral anomaly, you can prove the matching of axial anomalies by Tuft kind of argument, but you can also prove it without ever resorting to a Tuft-like argument, but looking formally at some correlation functions in the quantum field theory without any spurions. So our dilaton is very reminiscent of Tuft's spurions in the way we're using it, in the way we're matching the anomalies, and so on. But like people have done for the axial anomaly, it looks very likely that there is some way to get rid of this dilaton and come up with a proof which is completely independent of it. Now, also, it would be interesting to study the appearance of this anomaly and this universal four derivative term in holography, or in n=4 Young-Mills theory. So there is some progress, some mild progress on this problem, and we have checked that a simple holographic realization of spontaneous conformal symmetry breaking gives the correct functional with the correct coefficients, and you can compute the change in the anomaly of some sector of n=4 Young-Mills theory. But there is some general story that's still missing of why this is this bullet, of why when you have some general symmetry breaking in ADS space, why is there this universal four derivative term for the dilaton? How do you see it from the gravitational action? There are many examples in holography where some quantum field theory in the UV goes to some other quantum field theory in the infrared by a conformal symmetry breaking that's spontaneous. And then there should be a dilaton, and this dilaton has to have these universal interactions at four derivatives. It's not completely clear which mechanism in ADS CFT or in this ADS spaces leads to this universality. Is there some Chern-Simons term or is there something else? What we've done is to look at some examples in which we verify that that's true, but we've not a general understanding of why it works, although it seems to work in all the known examples. So it's not clear how this universality, how these Wessel-Minow terms are realized in ADS, and that could be a very interesting problem. Also, to generalize this logic to six dimensions seems feasible. So there could be interesting RG flows in six dimensions. We know that there are interesting interacting conformal field theories in six dimensions. So it's possible that there are interesting RG flows, and it would be interesting to prove a six-dimensional version of this theorem. And the biggest problem, which is the most interesting one, is what about odd dimensions, 2+1 dimensions, or even quantum mechanics? So the methods that I've been using all fail immediately in odd dimensions because there are no anomalies in odd dimensions. And I've been using very strongly the powers of anomaly, the power of anomaly matching and so on. But none of that exists in odd dimensions, so it's not clear how to proceed. So Rob and collaborators here have many interesting ideas about entanglement entropy and so on, and that could be the key. But this is the most challenging and the most interesting problem to be solved. And that's also interesting for condensed matter people who encounter critical 2+1 dimensional quantum field theories on a regular basis. So having such a theorem in dimensions could be very, very informative for condensed matter people in particular. So that's it more or less. Are there any?
How do you prove it using four-point correlation functions of space tensors? A comment on the previous slide.
Oh, yeah? This? Yes, so I've presented it as an open question, but we've made some progress towards solving it. So basically, the four dilaton interaction is almost the four-point function of the energy momentum tensor. And the reason is that the dilaton couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. This is how it fixes the conformal symmetry. It couples to T mu mu. So lowering the dilaton four times is almost like looking at the four-point function of T mu mu. You have to work a bit on the kinematics and on some small details, but it basically works in this way. So the reason that people have tried to prove the A theorem before failed is that they were using the definition of the A anomaly from the three-point function. The A anomaly appears naturally as a three-point function, TTT. But the three-point function doesn't have any obvious positivity properties. So using the fact that it's a non-abelian anomaly, we managed to shift the three-point function into a four-point function. It's because it's a non-abelian anomaly, so the same anomaly appears also in the four-point function. But four-point functions have nice positivity properties, which is really the gist of what I've been saying. This is really why there is some positivity on this object, because you can push it from three-point to four-points using the non-abelian structure. Any other questions? Okay.